Ryan Stanton here with ASAP Frontline. Today, taping in Chattanooga, Tennessee, a conference coming down for Tennessee ASAP Conference that I've done the last number of years. Come to see some fantastic ASAP folks here. And interestingly, the interview today is with somebody from Alabama, so we just used Tennessee to meet in the middle. So Annalise Sorrentino, emergency medicine pediatrics, UAB, one I've turned to many times through SEC ASAP, one of the leaders there for information on pediatrics and emergency medicine. And today we want to talk about where we're going, some of the new articles, things that have changed practice, and just a teaser of what we were talking about a little bit before we got started. There's some really interesting stuff. So, you know, turn it up. Make sure that you aren't too distracted right now during this podcast, because there's some really interesting pediatric changes and things that can help. And we'll put one teaser out there that I know frustrates all of us in community medicine, and that's topical otic anesthesia pain relief for otalgia. So we'll get to that eventually. So Annalise, thank you so much once again for joining us, and give us an idea of what's been going on in the world, and a little background on yourself, just in case some folks don't know about you.
Thank you, Ryan, for having me. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. I'm excited to do this talk. This is a talk just on some current pediatric emergency medicine articles. I work at UAB. I work at the Children's Hospital there, and I work in academic center, and I work with fellows and residents, and so it's a little bit easier sometimes to keep up on things because I have to go to things like Journal Club, but it's still hard. There's so much out there, and trying to pick out what's important for our practice and in this constantly changing world. And so I tried to pick out some articles that I thought would be useful and for common things that we see that would be good things to for anyone working in emergency medicine to use for kids.
So I understand ALTI is out.
ALTI is out. BRU is in. BRUE. Brief, resolved, unexplained event. And they changed that. They changed the nomenclature and they changed the definition a little bit to identify the patients or the children that they're worried, or to identify the kids that may have repeat episodes. Those are the kids that are at higher risk. And so, it must be brief. It must be less than a minute. It has to have resolved. It needs to be unexplained. So these kids that come in with, and we see this all the time, probably reflux, maybe a little bit of bronchiolitis, choking spell. We know why this happened. But had this episode, do we need to watch these kids in the hospital? And maybe we don't. If we have an explanation for it, and we can and do things to treat that, or if we know why it's happening, we may not need to bring those kids in the hospital. Now, there are kids that are at higher risk, and still the kids that are less than 60 days, those are tough ones. And so they're still considered higher risk, the kids that were born prematurely, the kids that got CPR by a trained medical provider. And that is one thing that they specified in the article, because I think we've all had kids. I had two this week that came in that got some sort of resuscitation by the parents, and it's just hard to know what to do with that. But so they did specify CPR by a trained medical professional. But those kids could probably, if they meet a low risk criteria, they could probably go home and follow up with their pediatrician. And I think that is a step in the right direction, because previously a lot of these kids got admitted to the hospital at least for overnight observation.
All right, so BRU is in, easy to remember, but not the spelling that you're thinking of in terms of after shift libation, BRUE. So let's talk a little bit about the single dose dexamethasone. I think all of us, when they come in, when patients, of course, asthma is crazy. I know in both of our environments where there's a great deal of asthma, and we're seeing the numbers continue to grow pediatric-wise, asthma cases. We have that debate, treatments in the emergency department, and then, of course, discharge with steroids, Oropred, or if you accidentally put the generic version that tastes hideous on there that the kids and families hate you for. Tell us about where we are with this change, this research out now about a single-dose dexamethasone. So the oral method dexamethasone, just like we would do with croup, now making its way into our asthma care.
Yes, and you know, again, bronchodilators and steroids are the mainstay of therapy for asthma, and one of the most common, definitely the most common respiratory chief complaint we see, you know, very common complaint in the pediatric ER. And the studies have shown that less than half of these kids will get their steroids filled when they go home. So is there something that we can be doing that might help compliance, that might help this, and is it making a difference in their clinical picture? So the study, you know, typically we use 0.6 per kilo to a max of 12 or 14 for croup. This study actually used 0.3 per kilo of dex compared with 1 per kilo of oral steroids, oral prednisone, for 3 days. And it was a non-inferiority trial. There was no difference. So no worse, no better, but there was no difference in repeat admission. There was no difference in ED length of stay. There was no difference in their respiratory assessment scales. So this is something that actually a lot of us have gone to. There are a couple other permutations to this. Some people send the families home with one extra dose of the oral dex. But as you alluded to, it's hard. Not all pharmacies carry it. It doesn't taste very good. It is a it's hard to get. The solution is it's a very high, or it takes a lot. I forget what the concentration is, but it takes a lot. So it's a big amount to swallow, which doesn't always go over well. So in the ER, we're very lucky because what we use is the IV formulation for PO. And so the taste isn't as much of an issue. And I know that's an issue if you are in a private office. You may not have the IV formulation, but most ERs will have it. And so we use the same dose. I use 0.6 per kilo. Like I said, the study was done at 0.3 per kilo, one-time dose, IV formulation for PO, and then I don't send them home with anything after that.
So good practice change there. And if you're thinking about stuff that you're sending home, whether it's adults or pediatrics, the vast majority of those are not getting filled or being taken inappropriately. I saw a number somewhere, but don't quote me on it, of somewhere around 75% of ER prescriptions are either not filled or used in the wrong way, like skipping doses. You know, the typical antibiotics, I took 3 days and now I feel better. My virus resolved in 3 days, so I still got 2 days of Azithromax. You know, there's azithromycin sitting around the house. Appendicitis is always a huge fear, and it's a fear of mine. Working in a community hospital, I don't have really good pediatric ultrasound access, and so pull the trigger on CT scan versus sending them to the academic center, which I don't want to overburden them with unnecessary transfers or the families and patients. Give us an update on where we are with appendicitis in the little ones.
So that's always a tough one, even in an academic center. And recently we have formulated a appendicitis pathway to try and limit radiation and increase the use of ultrasound a little bit more, because we're a little bit further behind. We don't do as much bedside ultrasound in the emergency department as done in general emergency departments. But all the appendicitis scores that we use, there's Alvarado and the pediatric appendicitis score, which we use. They do use the signs and the symptoms and fever and abdominal pain and right lower quadrant pain and rebound tenderness. But they always have labs that are correlated with it as well, white blood cell count and ANC. And so, you know, but then we all have the stories. We've seen kids with raging appendicitis that have had normal white counts. We've seen kids with high white counts that have not had, that for all the world seem like they have appendicitis. And so one of the studies that I looked at that specifically, just the white blood cell count and how does it perform in kids. I think one of the challenges that a lot of us have is that kids less than 5 years of age are very, very, very difficult to diagnose with appendicitis. And a lot of them, if not the majority of them, present after they've already ruptured because they don't classically present. And what this study showed was that actually the white blood cell count does not perform as well in the younger ones. The older you get, you can rely, the sensitivity and specificity of the white blood cell count is a little bit better in terms of appendicitis. Those younger kids are tough, and you just have to have a high index of suspicion and good follow-up and make sure you bring them back if they're not getting better. But those are going to continue to be an issue, but this study did show that white blood cell count does perform better the older you get.
Oh, great. So more complicated in terms of pediatrics. We just had the literature rodeo this within the last couple of weeks on the PO contrast, you know, debate, and so you know, appendicitis is going to continue to be a thorn in the side of us as emergency physicians. So we'll we teased it. So let's talk ears. I think parents and providers alike have been hideously frustrated with the fact that the FDA decided to crack down on otic type analgesia, so the abiotic and medications like that. And we had one pharmacy nearby that kept getting boxes up until about 2 months ago of medication. I loved it. Could call them. They're guaranteed referral to their pharmacy because they still got some. But now we have wasted that, and so now we're being creative, just like all emergency physicians tend to be, in terms of how to treat pediatric ear pain. Please, unlike appendicitis, give me some light at the end of the tunnel.
Okay. That was a sad day in July of 2015 when they took abiotic drops off the market. That was something that, for all that I do in the pediatric emergency department, that was something that I felt I made a difference. I could see someone feeling better, and it's been a big it's been very sad not to have that in our arsenal. So, and this is something that even on the PEDS emergency medicine listservs, that this was a topic that came up just last week. This is something that people are still talking about and still trying to find the best way to approach this. And anecdotally, people are using the ophthalmic preparations in the ear. Sometimes they're, you know, some people have said using topical viscous lidocaine might work. So I looked to see what kind of studies were out there, and these aren't really as recent, but these there was one study that looked at using aqueous lidocaine, 2% ear drops, and they compared it with placebo. It was a double-blind, randomized placebo-controlled trial, and there were no serious adverse events. There was a significant pain reduction at 50% at, they did pain scores at 10, 20, and 30 minutes. So significant pain score reduction at 10 and 30 minutes. Again, you know, this is the aqueous solution, probably not the true viscous, because you really need to get it down in there. And so I think that is an option. This is the same type of thing that sometimes I'll use this if there's a bug in the ear. Mm-hmm. To, you know, so the same type of thing. So that's been shown, and they looked at kids ages 3 to 12. Again, sometimes these are the toddlers that come in the middle of the night, because that's why you're seeing them at 3 in the morning. You're not seeing them necessarily. I mean, you're seeing them because of the ear infection, but it's not the antibiotic that they need. It's the pain control that they need. So one of the other, on the listserv, someone else had referenced that there was an article done that showed that actually olive oil might be an interesting approach to it, and that they had looked at that. So I looked back, and there was a study that compared, it was a organic otic solution, and the ingredients, the number one ingredient was olive oil, and also has some lavender oil and sunflower oil and garlic oil, and I'm sure, you know, it smelled, you know, nice. But these kids were randomized to either get the amitocaine and phenazone drops, which were the abiotic drops, versus this homeopathic preparation. And again, non-inferiority, but performed just as well. So, you know, it's 3 a.m., pharmacies aren't open, you can't get any lidocaine. This may be something that gets you through. It's kind of, maybe this is our honey for cough and, you know, solution to ear pain. I haven't tried it yet. I have done topical lidocaine, and it has worked pretty well. The problem is, again, what do you do for home use? And so this may be an answer to that.
I found that what I've started doing, other than the tetracaine for the eyes, the ophthalmic versions, transitioning them over to otic, would be to actually pull up a syringe of the lidocaine, a needle, and send them home with like a 5cc syringe with the instructions written on that. I mean, you know, I do I hear a lot about folks using the oils and things in the ears. I mean, it sounds like that one's going to make your child smell like somewhere between a combination of garlic bread and bathroom potpourri. But if it works, it works. And I think that's all parents care about. You know, and from a medicine standpoint, can I, you know, is making sure I have something, one, that's going to work, but two, is going to be safe, especially if we have some sort of if we have a perforation, because it's so small, especially that inferior border of the tympanic membrane. It can be very hard to see it. And, you know, kids are walling around. You're just trying to see the TM to start with. So if there's a small perforation, you know, knowing that that's going to be a safe preparation, because that is the big concern, the potential for ototoxicity in some of these cases. And I'm not sure where kitchen ingredients fall in the ototoxicity scale.
Well, when they looked at those types of things, so one of the things that they were talking about is the you know, why do these work? Why do these organic things work? And it was you know, the properties that they look for. A lot of it is the anti-inflammatory effects, I think, is the number one. But the study did show that there were, and you're right, it is hard, but no adverse events. They felt like it was very safe. And again, this was a little bit of an older study. This one was done in, I'll tell you exactly when it was done, but the some of the pain, the big names in pediatric pain management, emergency medicine, pediatric pain management, are the ones that recommended this study. And it was in 2001. So it's actually a quite an old study, and maybe one that we have forgotten. So,
what else is new and exciting for treatment of pediatrics? So we've got some pretty big hitting topics, four big hitting topics there. Any others that are really potentially changing for us in community medicine?
I think one thing that we have to start thinking about is a lot of us at Children's, we use the Broslow tape, and the Broslow system is an amazing system. It has revolutionized how we take care of these kids, and I think patient safety, medication errors, things like that have really improved. I think one thing that we need to start thinking about, however, is can we still apply the Broslow tape with the direction that our kids are going in terms of BMI? Do we need to adjust those? And they have done some studies showing that a significant number of patients are being underdosed based on the Broslow tape for their weights. And so trying to find a solution to that is difficult. There have been a few other products made that you will try to estimate, you know, you add 2 kilos if their body size looks a little, you know, more like this, or, you know, basically just match the picture kind of thing next to the Broslow tape. And I think that has performed fairly well, but I don't think anything has been perfect. I think that everything has had its issues. And so I think that's a problem. And maybe not so much with the underdosing, but there have been a much smaller percentage, but a percentage of kids that are getting overdosed with medicine as well, where that is overestimating their weight. So I think that's something that we're going to need to really pay attention to as we go forward.
Well, the bell for our bell curve is getting bigger.
Yes.
We've got a bigger base of our bell. I mean, I see kids that are tiny, and then of course I see kids that, you know, are born looking like they could probably drive a car. So, you know, they're coming out pretty large.
Absolutely.
That's basically, we've gotten into five things, you know, pediatrics that can help change your practice, change the way you look at things. And so I strongly encourage you to take a look at all of those things, try to understand how things are shifting, because it is shifting quickly. And if you decide to you know, sit back on your laurels within 10 years, you're going to find yourself way behind the curve. And especially with peds, because it can be so difficult, it's stressful for a lot of us. You know, this season we've had a lot of sick kids come in, and it's stressful for everybody involved. And so we need to do things to try to help these kids out. So give us an idea. Again, how can folks get in touch with you if they have any questions or anything for you from the emergency pediatric standpoint?
I'm always happy to talk to anyone. My email is pretty simple, Annalise, A-N-N-A-L-I-S-E, at uab.edu. And something else that where I get a lot of my articles and where I start first is a website called pemdatabase.org. And the person who does this website is nice because it really compiles pediatrics journals that and the articles that have an emergency medicine slant, emergency medicine journals that have a pediatric slant, studies that are, and it updates a few times a month, and there's archives that go back several years. So this is a good place if you're just sitting there and wondering what's new in pediatrics, you can just go through and look at the titles and see if there's anything that might be interesting to read.
PEMdatabase.org. So PEMdatabase.org. Once again, thanks for indulging me and helping me do better with my pediatrics. It may only be 15% of my patient population, but they can honestly be some of the most stressful and difficult to handle. And of course, we don't want to do anything wrong with our babies as much as possible. As for me, you can contact us. You can, I invite you to like our Facebook page, the ASAP Frontline Facebook page. We post all the new podcasts up there. Expect a podcast every Monday, except if it's a holiday. We may be a day behind there. But every Monday, you can expect a new podcast. Also on Twitter, at EverydayMed. Feel free to contact me, youreverydaymedicine@gmail.com. That's youreverydaymedicine@gmail.com. And until next time, I'm Dr. Ryan Stanton, and this has been some ASAP Frontline.